Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. As President Trump was arranging a trade truce with President Xi Jinping of China in Buenos Aires over dinner on last Saturday night, his administration was coordinating the arrest of a top Chinese technology executive who was flying through Canada. The arrest of Men Wanzhou, the chief financial officer of Huawei and daughter of its billionaire founder, is a serious, if not gangster, move by the Trump administration. What does this mean, and how does it bode for the future? For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He holds the Moores Professorship of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston and is one of the most prolific writers of our time. He is Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn, as always, sir, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for inviting me.
So the New York Times writes, quote, "The detention is a boon to administration officials trying to limit the global spread of Chinese technology, especially equipment that poses security risks, and to enforce sanctions with Iran. But the move threatens to upend sensitive talks to resolve a trade war between the world's two largest economies." The Asia Times writes, "The fallout from the decision has rocked mainland markets and threatened the trade war truce between Washington and Beijing." What's going on here?
What's going on is the beginning stages of a new Cold War. It was inaugurated, perhaps, on October 4th at a speech in Washington, D.C. by Vice President Michael Pence, augmented by another speech he gave at the Summit of Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation in Papua New Guinea on November 17th. It's apparent as well that Washington is going to find it difficult to compete with China economically. That was the import of a very intriguing op-ed written by former Harvard University President and Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton, Lawrence Summers, in the Financial Times. So what one can expect are these kinds of guerrilla raids against Chinese authorities. Recall that within the last 24 hours, another leading Chinese official, after being detained for a year, Patrick Ho, was convicted in New York City for offenses that supposedly involved African leaders. This was the allegation, that is to say that he was supposedly involved in trying to bribe Chadian President Idriss Deby. What happened was that a key witness against him was a Senegalese official who says he witnessed this attempted bribe. But this has not gone down very well in Senegal, not least because China has just funded a museum of black civilization, which in some ways makes the National African American Museum in Washington, D.C. look like a dollar store. So this kind of guerrilla raiding against China, we can expect to see more of it in coming days, weeks, and months. It's the beginning stages of a new Cold War.
I think it was reported in the Asia Times that never before has the United States attempted the extraterritorial rendition of a foreign citizen. That's, I guess, excluding what we did to a whole lot of folks during the invasion of Iraq and the war on terror. But anyway, Meng is a Chinese national in connection with sanctions violations. It has imposed travel and banking restrictions, but seeking an arrest warrant for this is entirely without precedent. It's hard. I mean, I had to call upon a mind like yours to help me navigate. Man, this is some real hardball here.
Hardball is the appropriate term. Recall that Huawei, the firm that is in the dock right now, that is to say its chief financial officer, is a competitor to Apple with regard to smartphones. It's probably number one in terms of telecommunications infrastructure globally. Recall as well that Washington has been putting pressure on its allies, such as Australia, New Zealand, and Britain, which are part of the so-called Five Eyes coalition, that collaborates on intelligence globally, Washington has been putting pressure on these so-called allies not to purchase Huawei infrastructure because supposedly Huawei builds back doors that allows it to spy on the sensitive communications in these particular countries. But if you step back and look at what's going on from 30,000 feet, what you'll realize is that this is a result of a backfiring of a foreign policy. Recall that it was in the early 1970s that U.S. President Richard M. Nixon went to China and worked out an entente against Moscow. And part of the payoff to China was massive direct foreign investment, not only from United States corporations, but also from Japanese and European corporations as well. It was not envisioned that this would lead to China becoming this juggernaut, which it actually is. And what's needed now, if you are operating on behalf of U.S. imperialism, is the kind of global coalition that was used to bring down the Soviet Union. But instead, the 45th U.S. president has ditched the concept of multilateralism. In fact, Secretary of State Michael Pompeo, at a recent speech in Brussels, Belgium, not only trashed the United Nations, but also the World Trade Organization and the European Union itself. Mr. Trump feels that bilateralism is the way to go. The problem is that that's not the way to go with regard to China, because as Lawrence Summers has suggested, it's very difficult for the United States to go one-on-one with a country that has four times the population of the United States and is on the verge of having a larger economy. Not only that, but at the Argentine meeting, which featured the talks between President Xi and President Trump, and understandably that got the headline, you also saw the emergence of another kind of organization. You know about BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. In light of the coming to power of Bolsonaro in Brasilia, the bigoted Brazilian leader, who also has made comments that are quite disdainful of China, BRICS might not be able to play the role that it played under President Lula. So now you have the emergence of what's now be called RIC, Russia, India, and China. Those three leaders had a trilateral summit in Argentina. You can see that particular coalition going forward. And what's striking there is the role of India, because India has been singled out as a country that will work with the United States and Japan and Australia in helping to encircle China. But instead, it seems to be moving in an opposing direction, which calls into question the anti-Beijing strategy of Washington, making these kinds of guerrilla raids by arresting top Chinese officials even more necessary. And I might also say that the New York Times yesterday had an article featuring Steve Bannon, the defrocked Trump advisor, who now is working with dissident Chinese with the aim, according to the New York Times, of overthrowing the Chinese Communist Party. So once again, I think that we are in the middle of a new Cold War, but the consequences perhaps will not be what Washington envisions.
And who's to say that Steve Bannon isn't aggressive and visionary? You know, you're mentioning Huawei and Apple. That takes me back to around 2011 or 2012, when I think it was AT&T that was buying Huawei systems. And you mentioned Huawei being in competition with Apple. They're also in competition with Cisco. They're also in competition with Northern Telecom, or Nortel. And they're one of the major players in the telecommunications industry. And there was I remember this article, and I think it has been pulled because I cannot put my hands on it anywhere, where a major amount of American telephone traffic, especially the telephone traffic that was being generated by the United States government, was being sent through Huawei routers and networks. And that was back around 2011, 2012. And many believe that that's what prompted the investigation into them and the claims that they were including those back doors into their networks, allowing for hacking.
Well, that would not be surprising at all. And note that the ostensible reason for the arrest of the chief financial officer of Huawei, which, by the way, is a company that was started by former members of the People's Liberation Army, and in fact is thought to be quite close to the Chinese Communist Party, which should not be surprising. The man who is perhaps China's richest man and perhaps one of the 10 richest people in the world, I'm speaking of Jack Ma of Alibaba, has a fortune of about $20 billion, including extensive and massive property in upstate New York. It was just revealed that he is a member of the Communist Party, perhaps the richest communist on planet Earth. But what's striking about this recent arrest is that the United States supposedly is concerned that Huawei is involved in sanctions busting concerning Iran. Now, you know that Mr. Trump, in early November 2018, has tried to tighten sanctions against Iran, which has been greeted with skepticism in the European Union. In fact, supposedly they're trying to develop a special purposes vehicle to circumvent these sanctions. But now, can one expect the U.S. authorities to try to arrest corporations headquartered in the European Union as well? Will that be the next move? And on that note, I have to say that I'm both disappointed and troubled by the role of Canada in terms of detaining the chief financial officer, because Canada itself is under challenge and under threat by Washington. Recall the rather insulting remarks that have been made with regard to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau by Mr. Trump himself. Recall the tariffs that are still imposed upon Canada, despite Canada inking NAFTA 2, North American Free Trade Agreement 2, in Buenos Aires. And yet, Canada, like some sort of puppet, basically danced to the tune of Uncle Sam and detained the Chinese official, which I'm sure will lead to retaliation against Canadian authorities themselves, if not Canadian corporate leaders, that can be found in China. In fact, if I were a U.S. corporate leader in China right now, I'd be walking around the streets of Beijing and Shanghai with my passport in my vest pocket, ready to take the next flight out. And, of course, we're talking about major U.S. corporations, including Starbucks, KFC, Microsoft, Apple, General Motors, et cetera. All are invested very heavily in China and now are dangerously exposed.
You just went to my next point, because I'm trying to figure out, Donald Trump hails himself or proclaims to be the guy that understands the art of the deal. And he's supposed to be, allegedly, negotiating to end this trade war with China. And he now makes what I consider to be an incredibly bonehead move. I don't understand why he still thinks that he can leverage President Xi. But even with that, I was going to say he's putting first of all, a lot of the tariff engagement that he's participating in against China is hurting American corporations that are there in China. And now with this move, it seems to be he's jeopardizing the lives of many of those executives, American executives that are in China.
Well, according to a recent report on Bloomberg, this is within the last hour or two, Mr. Trump has said that he did not know that the chief financial officer of Huawei was being detained on December 1st while he was conferring with President Xi.
Now, that was going to be my next question before we get out of here is, was he responsible for this? And if not, who then, other than Pompeo or Bolton, would have the guts to make a move like this? This sounds, unless he's claiming now to be MBS and saying, I had nothing to do with this.
Well, it's unclear. We know that there's a split in the U.S. administration on the question of China. You have doves like Advisor Lawrence Kutlow and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. You have hawks like Advisor Peter Navarro and Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, who Mr. Trump, interestingly enough, put in charge of this 90-day negotiation with China. Keep in mind as well that a recent column by conservative writer Roger Simon suggests that if these 90-day talks do not go well, China could retaliate, plunging the United States into recession and leading, I might say, to a bonus, which is weakening Mr. Trump's chances for being reelected in 2020.
So in the 2 minutes that we have left, how do you see this thing playing out?
Well, it's unclear. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me at all if China were to retaliate. As noted, Huawei is very close to the Communist Party. It's seen as the crown jewel of the Chinese economy. And this will not be taken lightly in Beijing, particularly in light of the fact that U.S. naval vessels are jousting with Chinese naval vessels in the South China Sea, and in light of the fact that the soybean farmers already are hurting, that is to say, in the United States Midwest, because of their inability to sell to China. China's ace in the hole, which the U.S. press constantly reassures us they will not wield, is the fact that they buy U.S. Treasury bills, to say they fund the U.S. government up to a tune of about $1 trillion and counting thus far, although of late they have not been buying as much as they had been in the past. And if China starts to dump those U.S. Treasury bills, which we are told would hurt the Chinese as well, but then again, if you have Steve Bannon seeking to overthrow the Communist Party, it seems to me the gloves are off and no particular approach or remedy can be ruled out from China's side.
Dr. Gerald Horn, as always, sir, thank you so much for your time. I greatly, greatly, and for your analysis and your insight, I greatly, greatly appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right, man. You are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm going to tell you, this move here by Trump makes no sense. You are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. U.S. lawmakers have brought General Motors CEO Mary Barra to Capitol Hill for a series of private meetings as the company comes under fire for announcing up to 14,000 jobs being cut. Barra isn't publicly testifying this week. She's been meeting behind closed doors today with several lawmakers representing regions that will be hit hard by the cuts. What's really behind these discussions? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a PhD in political economy, teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California, author and producer of various nonfiction and fictional works, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Dr. Rasmus, welcome back.
My pleasure to be here.
So Mary Barra has been traversing the halls of Congress and I guess being raked over the coals for these 14,000 job cuts. What's your take on this?
Well, first of all, you got to understand that the auto industry has peaked and it's already slowing the growth. And next year it could be in serious trouble. The layoffs by GM are a shot across the bow by GM to the politicians. What GM is doing here is saying, okay, we're going to lay people off unless you give us some more handouts. Now, what are those handouts? GM has been lobbying aggressively for Trump to impose 25% tariffs on German and other auto importers. So Trump has met with the German auto companies, and GM wants the import prices to rise 25%, and so that GM can raise its prices to offset its loss of revenue from a declining volume of sales. You see, this is about profits. You can get profits by increasing the amount you sell or by raising your price. So if you make it impossible for your competitors to undercut you by increasing tariffs on them, you can raise price. That's exactly what the steel companies did with Trump's steel tariffs. You see that 25% increase on steel tariffs, what has that resulted in? Well, the steel companies have raised their prices 22%. They haven't hired any more people. They haven't invested any more, but they can do that now and boost their profits because they've got the tariffs protecting them. Well, I think GM is playing the same game as the steel companies played with tariffs, but there's another tack here by GM, and that is GM and the U.S. auto companies are making a big push long-term into electric cars. GM has the Bolt model. Little known is the fact that energy credit, that 7,500 energy credit, has a quota so that once they sell a certain number of those cars, the 7,500 credit no longer applies. They want to release that quota limit so as they produce and sell more electric cars, customers can get the 7,500 credit. And we know if you've ever gone to a dealership, the dealers, the companies just mark up the electric cars to take that $7,500 credit. So I think that's also behind what GM is doing here.
Very simply, profit is price minus cost. So you can increase your profit by raising your price. You can also increase your profit by cutting your cost. Do you see GM with them coming up to contract negotiations fairly soon that they're also going to try to use this whole job-cutting issue as leverage against the unions to get the unions to take more cuts to save GM money?
Absolutely. That's another third element involved here. They've done that very successfully for over a decade. They've gutted the auto wages. You know, half of the auto workers get tier two wages, which is about half of what the auto workers who were there before 2008 are getting, and they get far less benefits, less job security. They've created a second-class citizen, GM has, in the auto industry here, and they're going to go after some more bites of the apple with the auto company, auto unions, and the auto workers as well. That's definitely part of what's going on. But I think the primary immediate thing, because, you know, negotiations are a little way off, is you know, to get the ability to raise prices. You're only partly right that profits are a function of prices and costs. They're also a function of your sales volume.
Absolutely.
More revenue if you sell more.
Absolutely.
Now, they're not able to sell more. In fact, the number they're going to sell is going down sharply. So now they got to turn to price.
Because their product mix has changed.
That's right. Price, jack the price up, and get the government to give you a shield with your competitors, just as they did with the steel companies, you see, and lower your costs as well by going after the auto workers.
Now, one of the questions that I've heard Mary Barra asked ad nauseum as she's been traversing the halls of Congress is, wait a minute, the government gave you this bailout, and now look at what you're doing to the workers. Don't you owe the workers some greater sense of responsibility? And then she dances around the question, not giving an answer. But it just, to me, begs, and President Trump has been saying this as well, to me, it just begs the question, I thought this was a free market capitalist economy. And so either you're for free markets and you're for capitalism, or you're not. What's pick one and stay with it.
Well, they're for free markets until they want a handout, you see, until they want a tax cut. We bailed out the GM and the other auto companies in 2008-09 to the tune of $80 billion, $80 billion. Plus, you know, they cut wages and everything, and they got even more profits. And has GM been investing in the U.S. for new plants ever since they got the $80 billion? No, they're expanding, planning to expand elsewhere outside the U.S., and they're continuing to do that, I guess. With Trump's tax cut, they got a big tax cut in January.
Well, that sounds eerily reminiscent of the bailout of the banksters during the savings and loan crisis, and President Obama was shocked and aghast that the banks did not reinvest the money that the government gave them back into the economy.
Absolutely. They invested it in financial asset markets in the U.S. and around the world, and also expanding elsewhere around the world. GM was a bank in 2008-09. What do I mean by that? General Motors Acceptance Corporation, i.e., a finance arm, a GM, was the major reason why GM needed a major bailout. Why? Because General Motors Acceptance Corporation was investing in subprime loans, home loans, and when they went bust, General Motors Acceptance went bust and dragged down General Motors. So it was really a financial crash that, you know, they got bailed out over, and now they're in financial trouble again, and we're going to see the same thing. You know, we got a lot of problems with subprime auto loans out there that the finance arms, the GM and Ford and everything, are now in trouble with over $1 trillion in subprime auto loans. And when we have a recession, people aren't going to be able to pay their car loans. They're going to turn over the keys, and that loss is going to hit the bottom line of GM and Ford and others.
There's another issue that I wanted to get your insight on. Trade conflicts have cost Nebraska economy more than $1 billion, according to the Farm Bureau. It says that Nebraska farmers have lost upward of $1 billion in revenue from ongoing trade conflicts, according to a new report that was just issued by the Nebraska Farm Bureau. Are these losses in Nebraska limited to the agriculture sector in the Midwestern U.S., or is this the tip of a much larger iceberg?
Well, the Midwest is carrying the brunt of it. You know, China has imposed an increased tit-for-tat increase in tariffs and has stopped buying soybeans, for example. The soybean farmers, you know, are all throughout the Midwest and even as far as Ohio and places like that. That's where they've taken some very big hits. Now, it's interesting that China has offered last summer to buy $100 billion a year more in U.S. farm products. Why is Trump not agreeing to that? Ask yourself that. And on top of that, China has agreed to open up its markets to 51% or more ownership by U.S. bankers and U.S. corporations, a main objective and demand of the bankers, the U.S. bankers. So they've conceded on two major points already. And what's stopping the trade deal? Well, it's technology and the anti-China hardliners on the trade negotiations team of the U.S., Robert Lighthizer, Peter Navarro, John Bolton, and others, they do not want a trade deal with China unless China agrees to slow its development of its China 2025 program to put China by 2030 in the lead globally in next generation technology development. I'm talking about 5G wireless, cybersecurity, and artificial intelligence, which has significant military implications. That's why the hardliners, aligned with the Pentagon, aligned with the intelligence agencies and the military-industrial complex, are preventing a trade deal. They're behind all of this. And the latest tactic is this situation arresting this Huawei co-chairperson up in Canada.
You know, as I listen to this and as I think back into the 70s and going back to GM and the cars, that it was American auto manufacturers and engineers that refused to recognize the changing in the markets, that the European manufacturers, the Asian manufacturers were designing cars differently, and the United States just refused to make the shift. And I believe that is continuing to have a huge impact in the American auto market, even to this day. American autos have gotten better, but they're still way woefully behind, even, you know, now what we see coming out of South Korea. And so, and also when you look on the technology side, we now have China eating our lunch with 5G. And I mean, you can go to Europe and you can go to Asia, and the transmission speeds make what we're getting here seem like telephones connected by strings. The United States refuses to keep pace with the world. And now we think that we can just bully the opposition. Again, I thought we were about free trade and free markets.
Oh, well, that's free trade, free markets is silly.
Is my assessment accurate?
Yes, yes. It's about protectionism. You just described a major protectionist policy shift by the U.S. auto companies that occurred in the 1980s. In response to the situation in the 70s, if you remember the 80s, the Japanese were importing all kinds of autos into the United States. It was called Japan Inc. They were going to eat our lunch. And so what did Ronald Reagan and Baker, James Baker, do? They forced negotiations on trade, just as Trump is doing, and forced the Japanese to become more uncompetitive. We've got the another version of the trade war, which is very similar to what Reagan did, you know, under Trump now, and which is similar to what Nixon did in the early 70s. Whenever the U.S. finds a major challenger, it restructures its trade relationships. That's exactly what's trying to go on right now.
So going now back to the agriculture sector, you know, it's one thing to retool a factory. For example, General Motors talking about closing plants in Ohio and Michigan and the discussions with General Motors CEO Mary Barra. You know, you can retool a plant, you can retrain workers, but what do you do with displaced farmers across the Midwest in the United States that could very well start losing their farms if this trade war continues? And by the way, this $12 billion supplement that the government is giving them, those are our tax dollars that are going to these folks behind Donald Trump's foolish trade war.
Yeah, and it's only a drop in the bucket as far as the losses for the farmers in the Midwest. You know, you're talking about $1 billion just in Nebraska. Well, what about, the Dakotas, Illinois, Iowa, Arkansas, and all the rest? You put them all together, the estimated losses are well over $50 billion. And we've only been in this tariff situation for one harvest. In other words, these tariffs only started taking effect in July. Mm-hmm. What if we got to go another whole year? The losses will be massive in the farm sector.
And I don't see taking the daughter of the founder of Huawei as a prisoner. I don't see that as being a way of making friends, influencing people, and getting China to acquiesce to your trade demands.
No, but if you want to shoot down and prevent trade negotiations coming to a deal because it doesn't have the tech issue that you consider priority, right? It's a good move. And it's very similar to what these hardliners have been doing here for the last 6 months. There's similarities with the ZTE Corp situation. Mm-hmm. There's similarities with the Broadcom situation. What the hardliners are doing with friends in Congress and supporters is to stir the pot by going after these tech companies that have a connection to China. If you want to really scuttle the negotiations, well, then, you arrest the second highest person of the biggest telecom company in China in Asia. That's Huawei.
Okay? So real quick, Jack, because we got about 45 seconds. Do you think that Trump, he's now saying he didn't know this was going on. He sounds like Mohammed bin Salman. I didn't know that they were cutting Khashoggi up with a hacksaw. Do you think President Trump really knew what was going on here?
Good question. I suspect he did not. I suspect that this is something that's being done by certain embedded interests, Pentagon folks and industrial complex and so forth, in anticipation of a deal that might have been made at the G20 that would have cut out this technology agreement. They did not want to deal without settling this technology thing. I think they were holding that in their vest pocket, right? Okay. And now it only came out. I really think in this case, I may be wrong, I'm just guessing, that Trump didn't know of it.
I got to stop you there. Dr. Jack Rasmus, as always, sir, thank you for coming to the Critical Hour.
My pleasure.
All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. As a result of the midterm elections, some more progressive voices are on their way to Congress. Congresswoman-elect Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez joined 150 youth activists in a sit-in recently at House Majority Leader Nancy Pelosi's Capitol Hill office, where the group called for congressional action on climate change. Well, what's behind this effort, and will climate change become a rallying cry or galvanating issue across politically active groups. For this, we turn to my next guest. She's the co-chair for the Green Party and joins us to discuss the Green New Deal. Gloria Matera, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Wilmer. Thanks so much for having me on.
So explain to us, let's start with, what is the Green New Deal?
That's a great question because it's being talked about a lot. The Green New Deal, as the Green Party of the United States and many of our candidates around the country talk about it, really has its origins kind of 2006 in the global Greens in Europe. But here, the Green Party is talking about kind of a massive emergency mobilization to address the great threat of climate change. And that really includes an economic bill of rights, a jobs program that will put people to work with a living wage, good union jobs, retrofitting in new clean energy sectors. It is looking at it as a public investment, public works project, where one of our main goals is 100% clean renewable energy by 2030.
Now, let's clarify some territory or some boundaries or let's understand some interrelatedness here, because today GQ has an article how Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal might help save the planet. Yesterday, The Atlantic, the Democratic Party wants to make climate change policy exciting. Just today and within the last couple of days, this is all seeming to be tied now to the Democratic Party. So my question to you is this actually a cooperative movement, or has the Green Party's Green New Deal become co-opted?
Well, interesting way to put it. And I think saying that the Democrats want to make it exciting shows, I think, once again, that it's about marketing and branding for the Democrats and kind of getting, you know, rallying people for votes. There were several Democratic candidates who talked about a Green New Deal during their campaign and have nothing to say about it. Now, it is true Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has gone the next step in promoting this idea, putting forward an idea of coming up with a committee, a select committee. Now, co-ops, I think that the Democrats are trying to make it mainstreaming. I think we see some kind of greenwashing about it. There are definitely similarities in the programs when the Green Party is talking about it and when I would say Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is talking about it. I don't see it as a Green New Deal, as a real important imperative taken up by the Democratic Party. And I think that's really the difference, because this is what's going to happen to promote this, you know, as far as legislation. And I don't see the Democratic Party taking this up, because it will involve, when you look at the Green Party's New Deal, a real restructuring of the economy. It is really kind of changing from capital and the investment and the lobbying of fossil fuel industries, big agribusiness. And I want to say, in terms of the Green Party's New Deal, well, how are we going to pay for something as massive as that kind of scaling up program? And we look at cutting the trillions of dollars in the military budget and the military industrial complex. That is not talked about by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And I certainly think it would not be talked about as something the Democratic Party would do in terms of shifting the huge amount of resources that need to be shifted to make this happen. Because, you know, as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has said, we have 12 years. They have once again sounded the warning. They have been sounding the warning, and no one has really been taking this seriously outside of the Green Party and, you know, I think a lot of the European countries.
So let's do this. Let me move to the focus of the Green Party and the Green Party's Green. We could spend a whole lot of time now going back and forth between you and the Dems. So let's do this. Going to GP.org, which is greenparty.org. The Green New Deal is a four-part program for moving America quickly out of crisis into a secure, sustainable future, inspired by the New Deal programs that helped us get out of the Great Depression of the 1930s. The Green New Deal will provide similar relief and create an economy that makes our communities sustainable, healthy, and just. There are four pillars: the Economic Bill of Rights, a green transition, real financial reform, and a functioning democracy. So why don't we see if we can get through the highlights of the four pillars, if you could start with the Economic Bill of Rights.
Absolutely. The Economic Bill of Rights is talking about a guaranteed job so that when jobs are not available in the private sector, that there is full employment, looking at all the different sectors that need to make massive changes, from transport to retrofitting, to be able to give people jobs and be able to enact the Green New Deal. The other thing we want that's very clear in the Green Party platform is our economic democracy plank, which really shifts from what we consider kind of corporate focus, corporate control, to much more democratically localized control, municipalization, public power, communities and workers working together to decide what is needed in their communities to be able to have sustainable environment and good jobs. And, you know, we're obviously looking at the importance of health, lifting people out of poverty and dealing with a lot of the oppression around racism that comes with what's happening lately in terms of climate and the fossil fuel industries and other industries kind of dominating that.
You know, a lot of people listening to the discussion of an economic bill of rights would say, oh, this is just pie in the sky and it's financially impossible. But I know Germany and other European countries, they may not have an economic bill of rights, but their economic structure and their economic systems are much more geared towards supporting people when they are unemployed than we have here. And I know if we weren't sending $38 billion or trying to send $38 billion over a 10-year period to Israel, and if we weren't looking at a $619 billion increase in our defense budget, we could probably find some money some places to do some things like this.
Well, there you did. Outlined exactly what the Green Party says, is that that massive amount of money, trillions of dollars in the military budget, and not just the budget, but as you said, supporting, you know, arms in Israel, supporting other aggressions around the globe. That is the kind of money that we say totally would be redirected and paid for the Green New Deal, the jobs program part of it, and the, you know, mitigation in terms of the climate crisis we're in right now.
So under your Economic Bill of Rights, you're calling for a living wage, you're calling for quality health care, you're calling for the right to a tuition-free, quality, federally funded, local control public education system.
Right, public, talking about public banks. And really what we're, I think the key here is when we say federally funded, where there is this massive amount of money, you and I have both just kind of outlined where that comes from, but locally controlled, where communities decide. Every community is different. Every situation is different. Every area in the country is going to be different in terms of what they can manufacture and what they can do in terms of clean, renewable energy. And emphasize clean, because that means it's not involving nuclear power. There's certainly some politicians, and we do have heard in the Democratic Party too, that, you know, nuclear power is a transition and it's quote unquote clean energy. And we want to emphasize that that is not true.
Well, let's take us to point number or platform plank number two, pillar number two, a green transition.
Right. Absolutely. Looking at how the government is going to support implementing the new kind of economy in terms of the transition to clean, renewable energy, the green jobs with the full employment that we can put people to work. We have, you know, one of our candidates often says, or several of our candidates say, we don't want an unemployment office. We want people to go down to the employment office and look at the jobs that are available and needed in their community that will deal with transport, retrofitting, producing clean, renewable energy. We really talk about the fact that the wealth needs to be transferred. And I think that's really some of the differences, although we've moved on to talking about the differences, is we're talking about a different kind of economy. We're talking about moving away from a capitalist economy where the corporations are dominating, where they're considered people, and really putting the control and the decision-making back in the hands of the community.
Now, the United States has, over the last couple of years, become one of, if not the, now with the largest oil producing nation. President Obama is taking credit for opening up production areas, and now between tar sands production and fracking, and which is natural gas, but they're now rivaling Saudi Arabia in terms of oil production. That conversation and how that conversation is being touted as victory for the United States seems to be taking us backwards instead of moving us forward towards a green economy, especially as we're looking towards the production of energy. Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes sense. We're not moving forward. And I think, you know, although the Green Party feels that getting the Green New Deal and some components of that out in the more general public is an important development, it is a concern that's kind of, you know, sexy and exciting to sound like it. But when you look at what's happening, what the United States is doing, both, you know, here and abroad, that is completely opposite, which is why we feel, you know, and looking at our other pillars on how in order you want to go, but really is talking about how do we change the electoral system? How do we elect people to office that are accountable and are actually doing the kinds of legislation, bold legislation, and making decisions that are the best for a sustainable planet and the people and all the other species that live on it, rather than making decisions of putting money where it ends up being the opposite effect. I mean, one thing that should happen right away, we would call for, is an immediate end to all fossil fuel infrastructure. Like, that doesn't necessarily need a committee to have a conversation about. That is something that probably can be enacted in state by state or federally. So even though, say, New York has banned fracking several years ago, there's still fracking infrastructure being built to carry fracked gas from one end of the country to the other.
And, you know, when you talk about restructuring the democracy, a lot of people would think, oh, so now you're calling to tear up the Constitution. But there are some very simple things, such as rank voting, rank order voting, such as proportional representation. There are some things that are very, very simple that could be implemented that would move us, I think, closer to what it is you're talking about without destroying the entire democracy. And you throw on top of those two things, doing away with voter, truly addressing voter suppression, and democracy in this country could become much more effective fairly quickly without having to restructure the entire premises of the country.
True. Well, democracy in this country could actually become democracy in this country if those things happen. And I, you know, I think that, you know, there's a lot of confusion for voters, you know, or we, you know, we're a democracy, but what does that really mean? We, you know, we are certainly a capitalist system, but also looking at, you know, we can have a whole, I'm sure you can have a whole nother show on what the Constitution really is and what that really means and what
exactly
to change and can't change. But yes, talking about what's happening now, and it's been happening, is, you know, voter suppression, where there are acts of turning people away from the polls or purging them. You know, we know disproportionately in frontline communities, and then also, you know, enacting electoral laws where you're getting money out of politics in terms of, you know, donations and campaign finance, abolishing the Electoral College, and certainly ranked choice voting, proportional representation. We can look at countries where Green parties are sharing power as MPs, because they have a multi-party system in other countries. We don't have that. Winner take all, suppress, you know, suppress smaller parties, suppress voter choice. That's all a big part of it.
And we got a little out of order, but the third plank or the third pillar, real financial reform. What do you mean by real financial reform?
Well, you know, talking about the, you know, the banks are too big to fail. I mean, you know, that's destabilizing. It did destabilize our economy. And obviously, small businesses, small banks, individuals really suffered being able to bail out those big banks. We're really talking about forgiving student debt, you know, looking at what happened in the housing crisis and people have lost their homes, you know, publicly controlling money, using public banks. I think there's one in this country at the moment, you know, kind of stopping those kinds of bailouts, bail out our students, bail out people who have lost their homes in the financial crisis.
You know, it's good that you brought that up. I want to jump in real quick because we're running short on time to make the point that folks are against financial reform, but it depends on how you define it. Because to your point, bailing out General Motors was public funding of a private entity. Bailing out the banks as a result of the foreclosure crisis, that was public financing of private interests. So, folks are against forgiving student loan debt, but oh my goodness, we can't let GM fail. So it really depends on which side of the ledger your interests lie. And I think people, if they really sat down and did the math and understood, if you financially empower the working class and financially empower the middle class, that's the economic engine that would really move this country forward.
That is absolutely right. I completely agree with you. You know, our students, our young people coming out with huge debt, with a job market that's not very promising. And of course, what young people are really talking about now is like, what kind of planet am I living on? You know, what will be my future? And we really feel in the Green Party, we can change that conversation. You know, we welcome hearing people talk about the Green New Deal, but we really want a platform to talk about how that will change society and change the economic balance in this country. And we thank you for that the opportunity to be able to do that on your show.
So we only have about a minute and a half left. What between now and 2020, how does the Green Party move this agenda forward?
Well, we will always have candidates who will be running on the Green New Deal. It's really a signature part of our platform and local and state candidates' platform. We are also a party of activists and organizers. So we will continue community by community, Green Party local by Green Party local, in the communities that are most affected right now, talking about what a true Green New Deal will be. We will try and lobby, of course, in areas where we can around legislation, but we're kind of, you know, we take it to the streets, we have our candidates do it, and where we can partner with grassroots organizations and groups that are really promoting a true, sustainable, equitable society around a Green New Deal, we're going to be there.
Gloria Matera, co-chair for the Green Party, talking to us about the real Green New Deal. Thank you so much for coming to the Critical Hour. Greatly, greatly appreciate it. Look forward to having you back. Hey, folks, you've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.